From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Two years ago, anti-apartheid activist Albie Sachs survived an assassination attempt. He lost an arm to a car bomb, but his beliefs remained intact. On this edition of Fresh Air, Sachs tells us about his work with the African National Congress. When Natalie Kouche was 6 years old, her parents developed a distaste for civilization, and the family moved from California to Alaska. Coming up, we talk about her family's new life in Alaska. It's the subject of her memoir, Road Song. And TV critic David Bianculli compares the spirits that inhabit Twin Peaks with those that have possessed the characters in the new miniseries, It. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. There have been few takers for Morocco's call for an Arab summit to discuss the Gulf crisis. Only three Arab leaders have said yes to an appeal by Morocco's King Hassan. NPR's Deborah Amos reports from Saudi Arabia.
Jordan and the PLO were the first to respond to the Moroccan proposal to find what King Hassan called an Arab solution to the crisis. Iraq's conditions for attending a summit make it almost impossible to convene one. The Iraqis say they don't want to meet while the multinational forces in Saudi Arabia. Later, Iraq set other preconditions for the agenda. Today, Egypt's President Hosni Mubarak offered to negotiate between Iraq and the multinational force. He said that Egyptian forces could serve as peacekeepers in Kuwait after Iraqi withdrawal. The president's remarks were reported in a leading newspaper in Cairo. In Riyadh, this is Deborah Amos.
A U.S. embassy spokesman said that threats from a purported terrorist group have prompted the tightening of security measures at American university branches in Italy. The official, who asked not to be identified, said six university branches in Florence and Bologna have been threatened with attack if U.S. troops move against Iraq. The threats came in letters from a previously unknown group calling itself the Secret Popular Revolutionary Movement. The embassy spokesman declined to release the names of the universities involved, but Italian newspapers have named four of them as Georgetown, Stanford, and Syracuse in Florence, and Johns Hopkins in Bologna. A Stanford official has denied its branch in Florence was affected. Cable News Network and attorneys for Manuel Noriega have reached an agreement that temporarily defuses a constitutional showdown over the airing of taped conversations between the former Panamanian leader and his defense attorneys. Jeff White has more from Miami.
Over the weekend, a federal appeals court in Atlanta upheld a ruling by District Judge William Hoover in Miami banning CNN from broadcasting tapes it obtained of telephone conversations between Manuel Noriega and his attorneys, and requiring the network to surrender the tapes to the federal court in Miami so it could be determined whether their broadcast would damage Noriega's trial on drug trafficking charges. Today, CNN agreed to stop broadcasting the tapes, pending its appeal of the matter to the U.S. Supreme Court. For his part, Judge Hoover said CNN would not have to turn over the tapes, also pending the Supreme Court decision. And Noriega's attorneys agreed to drop their motion of contempt of court against CNN for airing excerpts from the tapes over the past few days, in spite of the judge's order not to do so. For National Public Radio, I'm Jeff White in Miami.
Stock prices posted a sharp gain today as traders reacted to a drop in oil prices and hopes for the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 52 points to close at 2,540.35. Advances led declines by a margin of 3-1. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 2 years ago, South African lawyer Albie Sachs opened his car door and a bomb explosion threw him 30 feet in the air. Sachs was an anti-apartheid activist, living in exile in Mozambique at the time. He was among the first whites to join the African National Congress and remains a member of the ANC's constitutional and legal department. Sachs survived the car bomb attack, but he lost an arm and most of the sight in his left eye. He still has nerve problems in one foot and continues to find bits of shrapnel in his body. He's written about his recovery in his memoir, Running to Maputo. Maputo is where Sachs was living at the time of the explosion. He now lives in London. I asked him to reconstruct what happened during the assassination attempt.
Well, I didn't know it was an assassination attempt until afterwards. So I have to reconstruct not for you, but for myself. And that was part of what writing it all was about. I can just remember something terrible was happening to me. I sort of blacked out. Everything was dark. I was swaying. And I felt a huge, like a punch against the back of my neck. And I thought I'd banged my head on something, like when I used to climb Table Mountain years and years ago in South Africa. And I'd be dreaming about the struggle and freedom in South Africa, and bang, you know, I'd crack my nut on an overhang and have that same sort of concussed sense. The only difference was this time the sense of concussion just didn't go away. The darkness stayed with me. And then I felt arms pulling me, and I realized this was something awful and threatening and ominous and directed at me. And I felt I was being kidnapped, and I can recall shouting out, leave me, leave me. I'd rather die here, something to that effect. And doing it in English, which is my mother tongue as a South African, and in Portuguese, which is the most widely spoken language in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, where I was working at the time. And I can also recall, in a half kind of a way, doing so, shouting out, but in a sort of polite way, because after all, I was a middle-aged lawyer in a public place, and I felt that I mustn't make too much noise. These are kind of half memories, half sensations, and then fading out completely and being a little bit angry, everybody around me talking earnestly, energetically, tensely, but about me as though I was an object and not to me as though I was a person. Well, and then once more total darkness, and then a voice coming through, very gentle and very kind voice, saying, Albie, this is Eva Garrido. You're in the Maputo Central Hospital. And we're going to operate, and you have to face the future with courage. And I was so happy just to hear somebody speaking to me and hear a good voice and to discover where I was. And then I sort of mumbled, still in the darkness, what happened. And a voice said to me, car bomb. And then I just remember like fainting, but fainting in a state of bliss, of euphoria, because I knew I'd survived, that I was okay.
You don't really remember all that much about what actually happened at the time, but you've asked friends who were following the news to help you reconstruct what happened. How much do you know now, and do you know who was behind the assassination attempt?
Well, this is very strange, because I didn't want to know for about 2 months. I didn't want anybody to tell me. It was enough that I'd survived. But subsequently, I saw it on a movie. There were two people with video cameras nearby. I saw it on photograph. I can't bear to look at those pictures. And then people like pieced together what had happened, and it appears that a car, my car was mined with a bomb that exploded as I was opening the door. I was on my way to the beach, and that seems pretty clear. And at one stage, loads and loads of people were saying they saved my life. And I would bump into people in Maputo, and they would tell me they dragged me away, and I just didn't recognize anybody. And now it's turned around a bit, and people are claiming we tried to kill him. And I've heard this from at least two different sources, as though they get some kind of pride in saying we were the ones. One was a black Angolan working for South African military who's been in custody in Maputo, and the other is a white South African lieutenant who belonged to the hit squad and gave a very extensive interview to South African press, claiming with great professional pride about how they, well, it's true that they didn't actually manage to kill me, but they did manage to get rid of my arm, and it was a highly professional job done by one of their top operatives, and he was indignant at the fact that this operative wasn't paid the full rate for the job, and he felt that this was most unfair.
So no one has been officially convicted of the assassination attempt?
No. And, you know, in a funny way, it doesn't even interest me very much to lock somebody up for this. Won't give me my arm back. It won't make South Africa a better place. But what is important is for the truth to come out, for people to know what happened. I can only speak for myself. I can't speak for other victims of police brutality and violence. But I know I feel very, very strongly in my whole being that if we just do the same to them as they've done to us, well, what's it all about? But if the truth comes out and we can stop this kind of behavior in future, and if these hit squads are disbanded, and if we can get a democracy in South Africa, then it's all worthwhile. And that is very, very healing.
In your memoir, Running to Maputo, you write about how during the process of recovery, you decided to not use a prosthetic arm. Do you still not use anything? You lost your arm right above the elbow. Do you still not use a prosthetic device?
I don't use it. I tried so hard for 2 months. I wore the damn thing, and I practiced, and I just got more and more and more depressed. And I think partly I wasn't properly prepared for it, because people think if you lose an arm, the main problem is instrumental. The fact is, with one arm, you can do just about everything. The main problem is disfigurement. The main problem is image, your sense of yourself. And I just find that I manage much better as I am, exactly as I am, without the aid of what really is a cosmetic thing hanging on me and making me feel uncomfortable. I think everybody who's received an injury like this reacts in his or her own particular way. It's an extremely subjective thing. I just know that life is fun. I'm enjoying life very much as I am, and I feel unhappy when I wear the prosthesis.
Do you ever worry about making other people uncomfortable? By
that's
not wearing
it,
you know, because you have, yeah, right, uh-huh.
Yeah, that's like their problem. And people react to me the way I react to them. If I walk proud and I feel comfortable in myself, people feel comfortable with me. That's been my experience. If I feel timid, if I feel embarrassed, if I feel disfigured, then people pick that up. And I don't have any doubt about that.
My guest is Albie Sachs, and he's a member of the Constitutional and Legal Department of the African National Congress and director of the South Africa Constitution Study Center in London. He's written a memoir about his recovery from an assassination attempt, and it's called Running to Maputo. When did you join the ANC?
I seem to have been born into it, but I think, in fact, I became actively involved as a student age 17.
And what year was
we,
that?
About 1952.
How did you get involved?
When I got involved, it seemed the most natural thing in the world. It was through a student group. There was a lot of sort of accidental meetings, but I'd grown up in quite a politicized home. My father was a trade unionist. My mother was politically active. So in that sense, I grew up in an anti-racist environment. But what was important was discovering these things for myself. And that I did with a crowd of young people, black and white, at university. And once I got in, it just seemed the most natural thing in the world.
What's your role in the ANC now?
My main work is on the Constitutional Committee. It's wonderful work. It's marvelous. We are the founding fathers and the founding mothers, if you like, of our Constitution. We're doing it very consciously. There are a lot of us, and we're very anxious to get as many people, non-lawyers, involved as possible in different ways. But we have a key role in terms of propositions, of formulations. We've got a super team, a very, very strong team of South African lawyers, either members of the ANC or very close to the ANC. And we're working flat out now in making, if you like, drafts of drafts for the Constitution. That's my main work. I've also landed in some very hot debates on culture in the new South Africa. I wrote a paper for the ANC for an internal debate, which was subsequently released to the press, and that's provoked a tremendous discussion debate in South Africa. And I find I'm called upon constantly to speak about that.
Give me a sense of what you've called for that's so controversial.
Well, I said, although I'm totally against censorship of any kind, I would like to ban the statement that art is a weapon of struggle from our movement for 5 years. And I said, I'm somebody who's been saying this for the last 25 years. Let me explain why I feel that statement ought to be banned. And so the paper continues in that vein.
And why should it be banned?
Because it becomes a substitute for really facing up to transforming culture in South Africa. People just come out with it as a sort of incantation, as a slogan. And it diminishes art and it diminishes the struggle. It makes it seem as though art is something you haul onto the stage from time to time to liven up a meeting. When in fact culture really is who are we? We know where South Africa is. We don't know what it is. We don't know what it means to be a South African. And it's people in culture, in music, in dance, in poetry, in song, in painting, in film, in radio, who tell us what this thing is to be a South African, the thing that we're struggling for. And if we impose upon that tremendous enterprise a few rather banal slogans, we're just not going to get anywhere. So the idea is not to separate politics from art, because you can't do it, but to allow the politics to come in a natural way for people who are already engaged in the struggle, who are spontaneously or by conviction anti-racist, but to be more daring, to take more risks, to explore more, not to be scared of contradictions, ambiguity, fun, tragedy, humor, and to get out of this very solemn way of presenting political art that most of us have been, and certainly I have been, guilty of in the past.
You just returned from South Africa. Was this your first time back since your exile?
No, it was my first time back since my first time back. I went back, in fact, in May, June. That was my first time, my return after 24 years. It was an absolutely glorious return. I saw myself on American television afterwards, and it wasn't myself. This was a lunatic, somebody with, with shining mad eyes and a gaping mouth. And that's exactly how I felt at the time. It was just wonderful.
What impressions did you return with from your last trip? And what was the purpose of your trip?
The purpose was to go back the first time, just to feel the soil under my feet, to meet the people, to have that sense of joy and personal victory, if you like, of triumph, of achievement. This is what we've been fighting for. This is what we had achieved. Hundreds of meetings, nonstop, TV cameras following me around. It was a nice feeling to feel welcome in my own country. But also I wanted to see with my own eyes, what was it like, the South Africa I'd been talking about and urging people to impose sanctions against? What was it actually like to be there, to see the people? And the emotion was tremendous. I spoke mainly on university campuses, and I said, please, just a nice, quiet exchange of views. And people said, well, you might want that. The students are not going to allow it. There was singing, there was dancing, there was vivas, viva Albie Sachs, viva, almost like too much. But it was very warm, and I particularly enjoyed visits to Afrikaans universities, because these had been absolute citadels of racist, fascist, nationalist thinking. And the glow of the reception, the enthusiasm with which people there received me, was something more than just personal. This was like heart meeting heart. This was a sense of historic encounter, of tremendous achievement. And so I came away, I almost didn't have to fly back to London, I could have just flapped my 1.5 arms and I would have arrived.
The trip that you're describing, was that your first trip or your second trip that you've just described?
That was the first one. The second one, I've just returned, just before giving this interview, and I'm still glowing, because it was a continuation of the first, with perhaps a little less of the madness. And what was interesting was I noticed a lot of progress in the past couple of months, and even the short time that I'd been away. Things are moving forward in South Africa. There's tremendous amount of bloodletting. A lot of people are playing their last cards, trying to sabotage the whole agreement, to say, as it were, I kill, therefore I am. I must be recognized at the negotiating table. And it's not even necessary to do that, because there will be place at the negotiations for everybody. So that's all very bitter. But side by side with the bitterness, and I think a much stronger force, is the force for renovation and change, and people beginning to develop a new outlook. Apartheid is still there. It's a very divided society. It's a very unequal society and a very racist society. But what has changed is the outlook of people. And people, black people, are discriminated against, but you sense they are not oppressed in the way they were when I left South Africa. There's a sense of burgeoning freedom, a sense of achievement. And a lot of whites I met felt a thrill of release from the shame of being associated with apartheid, an enthusiasm that they can use their talents and their skills in a creative way. Many other whites are uncertain, they're unsure, they're nervous, but there's an openness that we never had before in South Africa.
Albie Sachs, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more about your trip to South Africa, from which you just returned. And my guest is Albie Sachs. He's a member of the Constitutional and Legal Department of the African National Congress and director of the South Africa Constitution Studies Center in London. He's just written a memoir about his recovery from an assassination attempt on his life in 1988. The memoir is called Running to Maputo. This is Fresh Air. Albie Sachs is my guest. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how it's felt over the years to be a white member of the African National Congress.
I've really felt myself really to be Albie in the ANC, and it's very rare the whiteness as such crops up. But I remember once when it did, it was at a funeral of a colleague and comrade friend of ours, Eddie Weinberg, a photographer, at a memorial meeting, and one of our African black comrades said, and Ellie was always willing to eat with us, and he made great sacrifices to be in the struggle with us. And I was the next speaker, and I changed what I'd prepared to say, and I said, I just want to say that I'm sure Ellie would have rejected the idea that he was making sacrifices, that it was an honor and a joy to be in the liberation struggle. And that's the way I felt. The cultural question is always with us. There are always things to learn. The race question never goes away, even in the best of movements, and I think we are one of the best of movements. But it's basically been a very positive experience, and I think I can say a wonderful life.
I know in the American Civil Rights Movement, there was a point, for instance, when SNCC, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, asked its white members to leave, and this was in part because of the feeling that whites would end up in leadership positions and end up in some ways patronizing the black members. And in order for blacks to really have self-determination within the civil rights movement, there'd have to be a period in which whites were not officially included in the membership of certain groups. Was there ever talk of such a thing in the ANC, or do you think that South Africa was in a very different kind of situation?
We moved in exactly the opposite direction. When I started off, I was in a separate organization for white supporters of the ANC. And progressively, we became integrated into the ANC. It was a question of a process evolving. And when you look at our leadership, I mean, who's going to patronize Nelson Mandela? Who's going to patronize Oliver Tambo? These are great leaders of world stature. We're extremely proud of them. They are happy to work with all South African patriots who believe in democracy in South Africa. And I think maybe what makes a big difference in South Africa is you have a very large, very confident, strong black majority in the society and a white minority. And the black majority have shown enormous generosity in a way that the white majority haven't shown in the United States. And this somehow makes it much easier for human relationships to emerge and evolve in the context of the ANC.
When you were living in South Africa as a lawyer, you spent time defending anti-apartheid activists. Did you always feel that the courts and the legal system was stacked against you? Was it possible to ever win?
Well, we measured winning by... At first, we actually won in the 50s when I started. We actually won. We got our clients off. But after Sharpeville, 1960, the banning of the organizations, everything going underground, We just had to try and manage loss and reduce. If somebody didn't get the death sentence, that was a victory. If somebody was sentenced to 15 years rather than 25 years, that was a victory. If we could expose a little bit of torture, I mean, there was a lot of torture, but give a little exposure to it, that was a breakthrough. And we were really using the tiny little crevices available in the legal system to defend people as much as possible and to expose as much as possible. Now, of course, we're thinking about a complete transformation of the legal system, using what was good there, and there were a lot of very profoundly good features in the South African legal system, but detaching them from the defense of apartheid, from the whole racist structures. To this day, there are still only white judges in South Africa. and of course making the law anti-racist and having a new constitution. So if anybody's looking for a good job, there are good jobs going for good judges in South Africa.
Have you seen Nelson Mandela since his release from prison?
Yes, I've seen him twice, briefly, and of course they were quite emotional encounters.
You used an alias when you were recovering in a London hospital from the assassination attempt on your life. When did you start using your name again and feeling comfortable about letting people know where you were?
You know, the alias was adopted by the London hospital that didn't want to give its name away.
Oh, because they were afraid that they would be vulnerable too?
Possibly. And it created enormous confusion in records, and the psychiatrist who came to see me was totally against it. I said, I'm also totally against it. So I never really used the alias there. It was just really for record purposes. Afterwards, when I came out of hospital, I acted in a kind of clandestine way, but the purpose wasn't to keep my enemies from getting at me. It was to keep my friends from reaching me. It was just too much. There were too many people. I had no privacy. There was just so much love, like pouring in, and so many people wanting to see me that I was just becoming destabilized. So I went into hiding from my friends. I've come out again.
Do you have any fear of another attempt on your life?
No. You know, I feel I'm indestructible. It's a strange kind of feeling, but I sort of don't care. And one of the things was I went back to Maputo as soon as possible, 7 months after the bomb. I deliberately went back to confront the scene of the explosion. And I just knew that psychologically this would lift the dread, and it did. And I'm so thrilled with what's happening in South Africa, and I'm so happy with my own recovery, and so happy to be back. And, of course, it's marvelous having the book coming out, and it's been, so far, it seems to be very well received, and people like it, and so on, that I'm just feeling, what more can they do to me?
Do you have any plans on returning to South Africa to live?
Yes, I'm definitely returning. It's a question of finding a place, and I know what I want. I want to be able to hear the sea when I wake up in the morning and when I go to sleep at night. And I'm taking steps to find that place.
Albie Sachs, I thank you very, very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Albie Sachs's memoir is titled Running to Maputo. Next time, actor Eli Wallach. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. So we finally know who killed Laura Palmer, or do we? TV critic David Bianculli re-examines last week's episode of Twin Peaks, and he previews the new Stephen King miniseries, It. In 1969, bored with conventional suburban life, the Kusch family moved from California to Alaska. Natalie Kusch was 6 at the time. During their first winter, Natalie survived a disfiguring attack that changed her life and the life of each member of her family. Coming up, we talk about family relationships and a family coping with extremes. It's the subject of Kusch's memoir, Road Song. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush will be meeting this week in Washington with leaders of Congress concerning the Persian Gulf crisis, amid growing concern among some members of Congress about the increased U.S. military buildup in the Middle East. Today in Washington, the nation's Roman Catholic bishops called for restraint to cut down on civilian casualties if there is fighting with Iraq. In Berlin, radicals clashed with hundreds of policemen today in a fight for control of a rundown street. The riot began as a protest against earlier evictions of radicals living in 3 houses in other parts of the city. Barbara Howard has more from Berlin.
Afternoon battles between police and squatters have continued into the night in East Berlin. With punk rock blaring and the black and red flag of the anarchist movement waving, the squatters set up roadblocks using old cars and trash containers. Many, wearing black hoods, pelted the police with rocks and flares. The police, clubs swinging, have moved in with armored cars and water cannons. The police are reporting 12 arrests, but say that there have been no injuries. The fight is over control of a dozen abandoned tenements in a depressed section of East Berlin, where self-proclaimed anarchists from West Berlin began squatting shortly after the Berlin Wall fell a year ago. The squatters had rioted earlier on Unification Day, October 3rd, protesting unification, which they say increases both nationalism and racism. For National Public Radio, I'm Barbara Howard in Berlin.
Presidential elections in Guatemala are set to go into a second round after 2 right-wing businessmen emerged neck and neck following yesterday's voting. As NPR's Alan Tomlinson reports, this contest could turn into a religious battle between Catholics and evangelicals.
The surprise success of the poll was the emergence of an American-educated evangelical, Jorge Serrano, as the new favorite for president. He swept from being a no-hoper in opinion polls 6 months ago to win about 25% of the votes. Serrano goes into a January 6th runoff against conservative newspaper publisher Jorge Carpio, who is a Catholic. With final tallies still being counted, Serrano accused Carpio of seizing on his religious beliefs to launch a negative campaign against him. The evangelical church has made huge inroads into Guatemala in recent years, but the country remains predominantly Roman Catholic. Serrano picked up votes from another evangelical, retired General Efrain Rios Montt, who was disqualified from the race last month by a constitutional ban on former dictators returning to office. I'm Alan Tomlinson in Guatemala City.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 52 points to close at 2,540.34 on volume of some 161 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. At the age of 27, Natalie Kusch has written a memoir, Road Song, about her family's new life in Alaska. She was 6 years old when her parents told their 4 children that it was time for an adventure. Kusch writes, "They had come, my parents said later, to distaste for civilization, for its people, its small and self-absorbed borders. Over years, they had observed in themselves a continuing unlikeness to their society, a growing unease at pinochle parties or church potlucks." So in 1969, the Kusch family left suburban Los Angeles for Alaska. But that first winter, something terrible and completely unexpected happened.
This was the first winter when we were still living in that original trailer without the insulation, no electricity. That winter, my father got his first job for the winter. He had worked road constructions jobs and small carpentry jobs during the summer before that, but our money had run out well before December, January. And in December, just before Christmas, he got a job that took him up to Prudhoe Bay, and we met for virtually the first time, the boys who lived through the woods about 200 yards, their names were Paul and Kevin. It was growing colder and colder. It was a sort of depressing dwelling that we lived in. And my mother would put me on the bus every morning, walk me down the quarter-mile driveway to the bus stop, put me on the bus in the morning, and give me her little orders all the time about if something happens and I'm not home when you get home this afternoon, please go to Kevin and Paul's house. Explain to them that I'll be there to pick you up as soon as I can. The reason she was so careful to explain this to me every day was because she was becoming more and more afraid of this place, Alaska. She was alone. My father was away very much of the time. There was very little daylight. What daylight there was wasn't coming into our house because we had all the windows boarded up for insulation purposes. She had to do laundry about 15 miles away in Fairbanks and haul water from about 25 miles away in a place called Fox, where there was a natural spring that came up out of the ground. So she would try to fit these things in at various times during the hours while I was in school. One day I did come home not too long after my birthday, and she wasn't there, and she had padlocked the cabin, which was real unusual. She never did that, but I think this was sort of a symptom of the fact that she was becoming more and more almost hysterical about the ice fog and the closed-in feeling in the darkness. So I went to next door to Paul and Kevin's house, and on the way there, had to walk through a yard full of these brand new dogs, a sled dog team that they had just bought and I hadn't known about. While I was going through the yard making my way toward Paul's house, there were actually two houses, these boys were cousins, one of the dogs attacked me and pulled me down into the snow, wound his chains around my leg, and several of the other dogs whose chains were long enough to reach me got into the act. And the next thing actually I knew was that I was waking up inside Paul's house, not able to see, but I was much more, much less cold, and my mother was there singing, and I heard most of Paul's family's voices.
I'd like you to read a section from your memoir, and this is a section right after the surgery, when your parents are meeting with the three surgeons who operated on your face after it was torn apart by the sled dogs.
I was still alive, they said, but only barely, and probably not for long. I had sustained over 100 lacerations from the shoulders up and had lost my left cheekbone along with my eye. They'd saved what tissues they could, filling the bulk of the cavity with packings, and what bone fragments they had found were now wired together on the chance that some of them might live. My father groped for a positive word. At least she doesn't have brain damage. I heard she was lucid before surgery, he said. Dr. Butler brushed the surgical cap from his head and held it, twisting it in his hands. His eyes were red as he looked up, explaining as kindly as it seemed he could. A dog's mouth, he said, was filthy, filthier than sewage, and all of that impurity had passed into my body. They had spent 4 hours just cleaning out the wounds, pulling out dirt and old berry leaves and dog feces. Even with heavy antibiotics, I would likely have massive infections, and they would probably spread into my brain. His voice turned hoarse, and he looked across at Dr. Arp, asking the man to continue. Dr. Arp rubbed hard at the back of his head and spoke softly, working his neck. For now, he said, they had been able to reconstruct the eyelids. That would make the biggest visible difference. On my parents' first hourly visit to intensive care, Mom stopped at the door and put her hand to my father's chest. No matter how she looks, she said, don't react. She'll be able to tell what you're thinking.
A lot of your description of your accident and what it did to your face is really based on your parents' memories.
Mm-hmm.
How much do you actually remember yourself?
I remember very much of the accident myself, and actually it was only very late in the writing of this book that I decided to put it in, from my point of view at all. But in my mind, although I didn't quite know what I was doing when I started this book, I had the idea that really what happened because of the accident was more important to the purpose of this book or to the idea of this book than what happened during the accident. I guess telling the story from my parents' point of view, based on things my mother had written down and stories my father had told me about his mind during that time, was an effort to tell this story based on the ramifications that the accident had, and what happened in these people's head was really part of that set of ramifications.
Oh, some of this is so moving. Your mother told you that you can't know what it was like to watch air bubbles where a nose should have been and to pray that each of your breaths was the last one. This is right after she'd found you and she was waiting for an ambulance to come. How long did she wait to tell you that? When did you think it was safe to give you the burden of knowing what she had experienced?
This wasn't until I was probably 12 years old, I think, when, and she wouldn't have brought this up herself at all, except that I kept asking her, until she finally decided to sit down and talk to me about it, I kept asking her why this had affected her so much. I was really confused as to why, if I was the person who had been bitten, why she was the person in the family who seemed to become sort of most terrified after the accident. And so for her, that was sort of an explanation. She didn't quite, I think, know how to tell me these things without going into terribly gory detail. But I wonder now if maybe she wasn't confused on the point of why I wasn't so forever affected by this event.
Why weren't you?
I wonder that myself. I think maybe it's because she was there. When I woke up, she was the person who had found me, and my next memory of the accident, sort of sequence of events, was her voice, and she never ever became hysterical or broke down in front of me. It was real important to her not to do that. So the whole thing actually took on a fairly normal sense to me, that this was just sort of the next event in a life that we had lived that was really rather bizarre anyway.
Well, you think that your mother seemed to have lost more in the accident than you did. How so? Do you think she felt very, very guilty about not having been there when you came home from school? Because if she was there, you would have gone into the trailer and you wouldn't have been attacked by the dogs.
Yeah, that, and also I think she was already building up such a terror of the dark and the cold and being alone. And also, this was the time in Alaska when there was very little in the way of communication. Mail to my father at the North Slope took many, many days to get there. She was very cut off. And I think this had been building toward and after my accident. When she found me, she was really the only person, essentially in the world at that point, it must have seemed.
Natalie Kusch is my guest. She's written a new memoir called Road Song. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Natalie Kusch is my guest. She's written a new memoir called Road Song. Do you think that the accident made your parents think that it was a mistake to have moved to Alaska?
No, not at all. If nothing else, my parents used to say, the thing we did come out of this experience with, or we did find by moving to Alaska, was the one thing that we had wanted, which was, ironically, that very sense of being utterly alone in the world. And my mother, I think probably part of her dark feelings those first years after the accident came from that strange paradox she must have seen, where what she had wanted was this was this solitary self-sufficiency, and the very thing that was frightening her or preying upon her mind as a mother more than as a single human being was that aloneness.
After your accident, you went through many reconstructive operations. You were in and out of hospitals for quite a long time. What was the final result like? And I should say that I'm speaking in Philadelphia. You're talking to us from St. Paul. How successful were the operations physically and cosmetically? Because there was physical damage that had to be fixed in order for you to survive. Then there were the cosmetic concerns.
Mm-hmm. The survival surgical techniques took about the first perhaps 5 years, and there were various cosmetic techniques for about 10 years after that. Actually, even after the initial battery of life-saving surgery was over, my face didn't look too bad. Part of the time that they took was making me a nose and earlobes and eyelids that very first night of the accident, and then after that also. But now I have regular facial structure. The left side of my face with the missing eye has very few bones or muscles, but people tell me that they don't notice those things, and, well, I guess I'm more or less inclined to believe them.
So you wear a patch because you have no eye.
Right. And, they gave up on a glass eye. We gave up on a glass eye when I was about 20 years old, and my body had rejected about probably the 15th attempt at a bone graft to prepare a cheekbone and orbit for a glass eye. And I suppose I still could be trying to have a glass eye, but after a while, the idea of another surgery became far less tolerable than the idea of wearing an eye patch forever.
You know, when I was reading your book, I thought, well, this is a girl who's going to grow up to be frail because she spent so much time in and out of hospitals. And also, I assumed that you would be spending a lot of time just protecting yourself from physical harm because your face was so vulnerable. So instead, you grow up to be kind of tough. You learn to defend yourself and to beat up kids who are picking on you or picking on your younger brother and sisters. And I couldn't figure out how you managed to do that.
Maybe that was because of my mother again. I'm making her during this discussion out to be a terribly frail person herself, but actually she was the person who would follow us to school and pick up children by the hair, essentially, who had called me, you know, a terrible name having to do with my one eye, and who would go and bellow at our teachers if she felt like they were not trying to take care of this sort of persecution themselves. And after a while, when we moved to Delta Junction when I was in fifth grade, a couple of years after that, she became the business manager of our school district. It was a very small town, and she couldn't go on making physical threats against the children or the parents of people whom she worked with. That just wouldn't have been a good professional move. And I sort of took that on after a while. I got real angry, and I didn't understand why she was no longer being quite so much our champion. So, and since my brother and sisters tended to be the children picked out in any given class to be the scapegoats for everyone else's, you know, anger or boredom, I had a lot of time for learning how to fight.
One of the mysteries your book really doesn't answer is how you became a writer and how you became such a good writer. When you went to college, you were studying medicine. Apparently, you gave that up and decided to become an English major. But when did you start writing? When did you realize you had a gift for it?
I guess I still feel I'm only an apprentice-quality writer. I sort of fumbled my way through this book because I ended up mysteriously with a book contract after having attended a writer's conference the month after I graduated from graduate school. During graduate school, it was a graduate program in creative writing. I was little more than a wannabe writer. That month after I got this book contract based on what was my master's thesis, was a couple of essays on our family, I was just terrified and elated, I guess, but really more frightened than everything else. And I've spent the last 3 years since also terrified because I never did know what I was doing writing this book.
So you're afraid you won't be able to do it again?
Well, I guess I still feel a bit shy in the light of writers I know who have passed that first book and who know essentially what it costs one to write a book and who, knowing that cost, are still going on to write further ones. I suppose I don't really want to call myself a writer until I know that I can now know what it's going to cost me to write one and still do it again.
It's customary on new books, on the hardcover versions, or on the dust jacket, have a photograph of the author. There is no photograph of you on Road Song. Did you not want the photograph on there?
No, as a matter of fact, when I first read my book contract, I had a lot of people giving me advice on what I needed to stipulate and ask my agent to stipulate for me. But the only thing that I really had an idea, a strong idea about myself, was the fact that I didn't want, on this book particularly, not on every book in the future, but on this book particularly because of the subject matter, I didn't want an author's photo. Because I think it goes back to the question of what is the focus of this book, and I don't think that this terrible thing that happened to me when I was a child is by any means the central event or the central idea in Road Song. And I'm afraid that I really thought that would be sort of catering to perhaps the less or the more gruesome curiosity of people who might tend to read a book about a child who was almost killed and spent a lot of years almost dying, and now these people would just like to see, well, how did she turn out? The book does state that I'm fine now, and I think really in some ways that's enough for me.
Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Natalie Kusch, that's KUSZ, is the author of Road Song. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Terry. Deborah Amos reports from Saudi Arabia on the possibilities announced this weekend of an Arab summit to deal, possibly, with the political standoff in the Persian Gulf. Also a discussion this evening of how the Catholic Church decides on how saints are to be made. A call from the conservative side of the Republican Party, namely the Heritage Foundation, for President Bush to return to the principles of the Reagan years or else face criticism or even possibly an insurrection from that part of the political spectrum, and a report from the University of Maryland, a plan to encourage young black men to earn advanced degrees in mathematics and science.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Saturday night on Twin Peaks, the giant warned, it is happening again. Well, it's happening again for Fresh Air listeners, too. TV critic David Bianculli is talking about Twin Peaks.
This Saturday on Twin Peaks, Laura Palmer's killer will be revealed.
Yeah, give me a break.
No, really. Saturday, you'll find out.
That was the ad ABC ran last week, prior to Saturday's installment of Twin Peaks. So who done it? Leland. Kind of. In the climax of that show, Laura Palmer's mother dragged herself downstairs and collapsed, either drugged, hurt, or dead. Her husband, Leland, calmly ignored her. And when Maddie, Laura's look-alike cousin, came downstairs, Leland attacked her. Well, actually, it wasn't Leland. It was Killer Bob, the evil spirit who had taken up residence inside Leland's mind and body. He was coming out to do some more dirty work. Viewers saw what the psychic Maddie saw. Leland turning into the long-haired, animalistic Bob as he beat her, held her, danced with her, and, in moments of relative awareness, grieved for his dead daughter, Laura.
Laura. Laura. Laura. Laura. Laura.
At the end of that scene, Leland smashed Maddie's head against the wall and inserted a cutout letter under her fingernail. The clear implication, if anything about Twin Peaks can be called clear, is that Killer Bob used Leland as his human host and, through Leland, incestuously attacked Laura, corrupted her, and eventually killed her. Very creepy stuff, and it's a resolution that makes sense. But there are still a lot of unanswered questions, and I'm not even sure that Killer Bob doesn't hop from body to body like Sam in Quantum Leap. And besides, some of the people here are so sick of me talking about Twin Peaks that I'm going to move on and review another TV show about an evil force that pops up to feed on fear and kill people. This one is Stephen King's It, made into a 4-hour miniseries by ABC. The story is about childhood friends who conquer an evil spirit, then reunite as adults to face the same horror again. Richard Thomas, John Ritter, Harry Anderson, and Annette O'Toole are all in the cast, and when It takes the shape of a ghoulish-looking circus clown, he, or it, is played by Tim Curry, famous from the Rocky Horror Picture Show. The clown, like Killer Bob, pops in to haunt people and sometimes manipulate them, as he does with this mental patient. Notice that Curry, who's British, uses a voice that sounds like it was based on a Mel Blanc cartoon character.
Henry. Henry Bowers. Up here, sharp stuff. Up here. You helped me once, remember? You chased those brats. Almost got him, Henry. Almost. Don't you want another chance? You gotta go back and finish the job. You gotta go back to Derry and kill them all. For me, Henry. Kill them all. Henry, kill them all. Kill them all. Kill them all.
It, the evil being, is supposed to confront each person with his or her greatest fear. But in this TV production, the special effects are more silly than scary, and only the character development, especially when the heroes are seen as young kids, makes it worth watching. If you want scary, stick with Twin Peaks.
David Bianculli is TV critic for the New York Post. Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers are Thad Kirk, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Chris Spurgeon directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet veteran actor Eli Wallach. He's in the forthcoming movie Godfather 3. And the cartooning team Drew and Josh Allen Friedman talk about their bizarre gallery of washed-up actors, nightmare teachers, and grown men who sell comic books. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.